Hi, I'm Sam Hammond. I live in Nova Scotia, Canada. I'm a high school student.
And I am Maha, and I live in New York, and I am a freelance journalist.
Alright, so today we're basically going to talk about New Left environmentalism and some of the more philosophical undercurrents that are problematic with actually trying to deal with the issues. So, back in September, the nation had a food issue, and this article sort of stuck out as the main problems with the New Left's critique of basically industrial capitalism. And it was called Ending Africa's Hunger, and basically the whole thing was a rant about the Green Revolution and how it didn't really address the fundamental problems. And it contains some pretty significant like conspiracy theories, which I think are pretty common among this sort of strain of environmentalism. It argued, in effect, based off of John Perkins' work, that the Green Revolution wasn't supported by the U.S. because it would help the poor, but rather it was supported by the U.S. because the U.S. feared that if the people in India and elsewhere got too hungry, that they'd have sort of a left-wing grassroots revolt. So the U.S. in effect supported the Green Revolution to sort of suppress the revolutionary tendencies in India and in other places from sort of fighting back against people suppressing them. So
wow.
I don't know about you, but
that's fantastic. Yeah. Who wrote that?
It actually had three authors, like three co-authors, and Raj Patel and Eric Holt Jimenez and Annie Shattuck.
Okay.
Three names I'm not really that familiar with. But like I'm sort of used to picking up a magazine and sort of I come to expect that organic food and stuff like this is going to be taken for granted. But the whole idea that the Green Revolution was some sort of U.S. bromide to keep left-wing radicals in India from pushing back, to sort of keep them complacent. it was way more than I expected, even from the nation.
Right. But it gets to the... We started here because it gets to the heart of a lot of what's problematic about the way that, sort of liberals make environmental arguments. Now, I feel like, we make the cultural argument for organic food or for alternative energies or for whatever it is. And the cultural argument is sort of premised, like you said, on being, radically anti-capitalist. So it ends up being very conspiratorial. It ends up being, sometimes to the point where, it starts to run counter to its own interests. So, it's hard for me to reconcile, the sort of, a lot of these like food documentaries, Food Inc. or Super Size Me or whatever, that are making this critique about how, bad food is being sold to us and it's this big corporate conspiracy, with the fact that at the end of the day, the ways out of any of those conundrums are going to come from sort of, new technologies of one form or another, that, or in the case of food, like new agricultural innovations or whatever, that are going to be developed by corporations. It seems so obvious, but I think I think you're right. A lot of the language of the sort of food movement tries to kind of dispense with that.
Right. So what makes it such a good example is because it sort of has the three main tendencies. The main problems are all sort of exemplified in it. The one is a tendency towards conspiracy. Another one is a rejection of technological and sort of institutional fixes.
Yep.
Instead favoring sort of this consciousness flipping. You got to change your lifestyle. You don't have to just change the laws. You have to start living out in the outback, this kind of mentality. And the third is just sort of rejecting, making these, even when there are successes, sort of ignoring them or explaining them away as something else. So like you said, probably most of the innovations, even though Monsanto has lots of problems with it, since they own 90% of agricultural industry,
right,
it's going to be inevitable that some of the innovations are going to be coming from them.
Right.
But what's weird about the Green Revolution is that it was completely public. It wasn't private industry. Norman Borlaug he wasn't working for anyone. In fact, I think he turned down corporate jobs in favor of just breeding, trying to find better crop breeds.
Right.
I have a little quote from the same article, which sort of gets just to exactly what you're saying. It said, one of the most important choices involves the role of technology. And by the way, in the article, it criticized Bill Gates Foundation for sort of partnering with biotech firms to try to bring a green revolution to Africa. And it was arguing against the green revolution in Africa for various reasons. But the quote goes on and on. The reliance on technology to addressing a growing political and social problem loudly echoes the thinking behind the first Green Revolution. And it talks about how, the technology fix isn't actually the right kind of fix. But I can't think of an alternative way to fix something. If people are hungry and if they need food, which is a pretty large section of people, the bottom billion,
right,
they need food. It's not going to come from sort of changing your life cycle or recycling more. It's going to be coming from technologies, new technologies, genetic engineering, working out better and safer pesticides, stuff like this, trying to make crops that are drought resistant. But they just resist it relentlessly and without very convincing reasons.
Well, it's also that, most of, while there are, legitimate concerns to be raised about a lot of those things, the arguments that, a lot of liberal environmentalists make aren't those arguments. So, for example, there are legitimate health concerns with some, sort of, genetically modified foods. There are, at the same time that the Nation had that food issue, the Times Magazine had its food issue. And there was a piece in there, and the author skips my mind now, that was sort of looking at medical studies that I guess show some kind of sort of cyclical correlation, like a kind of vicious cycle between a kind of processed food that's like really artificial and poverty, where it's true that that food is mass-produced and it's cheap, and so it's like really hard to get people to shop at Whole Foods because they can't afford it, but at the same time, it's also true that the more they eat processed food, the more likely they are to stay in poverty because it degrades their health. And there's this sort of that there are actually studies that show, I guess, that the worse your health gets, the less likely you are to be able to move up. I don't know enough about medicine to know how valid that argument is, but I at least feel like that argument was trying to make a legitimate economic case. In a way that I think, some of what you're citing isn't, right? But, something like that is something that, you can look at the data and you can see which types of foods do that, and then you can eliminate those. There are incremental changes that can be made based on an argument like that to solve the problem. It doesn't require deep cultural revolution in the way that I think a lot of other things do. I mean, the same could be said for, broadly speaking, for organic food. There are easy fixes. Like, if the U.S. government were to pass, labeling laws, which we don't have right now. So there's no requirement on, the big agricultural firms to, kind of tell you what they're doing. I think it's totally fine for them to do what they're doing, but you as a consumer should at least have access to that information. That's something that could be done within the system.
What's sort of strange is not only has sort of the attention to anti-genetic modification and anti-conventional agriculture, not only has that sort of gotten wrong or diverged from mainstream environmentalism, but it's also sort of diverged from what used to be mainstream left-wing tenets.
Right.
You know,
nice segue, Sam.
The left wings used to care about the working classes. Now, and now they basically criticize the working class relentlessly for shopping at Walmart and for buying food that has been heavily processed or was made of pesticides. And it sort of has stopped being a left-wing critique, and it started being this morally superior critique.
Right, and that's when I think liberalism really started to get its kind of like stigma quality here in the States, at least. It was when it became this sort of elitist thing. I'm confused to some degree about exactly how that happened. I think when we were emailing to kind of set this up, you said you made the point that a lot of this has its roots, in the 1960s and in sort of the counterculture and in this idea that you can't solve any specific policy problem without sort of like uprooting the values that undergird the society or whatever it is. And yet, I think you're right. I think that's true about the cultural part of 60s liberalism. But I also think, that the 60s had both, right? That there were two very distinctive strains in 60s liberal thought, right? There was the part of the counterculture that was sort of this very anti-institution, sort of radical individualism, social upheaval type zeitgeist. And at the same time, especially among sort of academic circles, there was, a language that was more more communitarian, more sort of more inclined to kind of recognize institutional power and just sort of make arguments that the institutions themselves were flawed, and that sort of turned more towards like a kind of economic liberalism that you're talking about. And I think there is sort of an inherent tension between economic liberalism and cultural liberalism, because economic liberalism is like all about institutionalized power. It's about making the argument that the state should intervene to do X or Y. And cultural liberalism is all about, protecting the individual from that kind of intervention. For whatever reason, because their interests were aligned in the 60s, at a certain point, those groups were working together. And I think what really happened is not that economic liberalism got lost, but that it, like, disappeared, but that the cultural liberalism was always there, and it just kind of won out.
Right. But what you say about, like, sort of trying to uproot the values of society is exactly right. The titles, or at least the subtitles on the articles in The Nation, were things like, they were called freedom fighters, and they're fighting for food democracy. And one woman in her sort of resume at the bottom of the article said, called herself a food justice activist. And it's just these sort of absurd things. This should just be something that's very empirical and very straightforward, and you don't have to be a food justice advocate or anything like this. We should just sort of look at the facts and ask ourselves, what can we do to actually curb the environmental problems that we see around us? So I want to sort of trace some of the specific philosophies that I would argue that they're sort of on the fringe. They're definitely very fringy, and they definitely don't represent mainstream environmentalism at all. But the thing is, it sort of has a trickle down effect where the ideas on the fringe have sort of permeated the vocabulary, at the very least, of the mainstream people. And specifically, I'm talking about like the deep ecology movement, which basically argued that instead of having shallow fixes, we need deep fixes to stop to help environmentalism. That humans are is very pessimistic about humanity. It says that humans dominate nature, and that we need to emancipate nature. And even though this seems really extreme, it comes up in mainstream environmental literature all the time when they talk about how the Earth is a spaceship and the Earth is an organism and we have to look after Mother Earth and stuff like this. The biggest problem with this, from my perspective, is that first I think it makes some sort of, it makes a bit of a conceptual error. Nature itself isn't really a thing. I mean, nature is everything, and it's nothing at the same time.
Right.
So to say that we need to help nature, quote-unquote, just doesn't really make sense. I mean, it's just as natural for there to be trees as there is for it to be just barren wasteland. So the philosophy suffers at the outset from being sort of way too vague, way too ambiguous.
Right.
But in many ways, that's its appeal to people. They can just sort of project what they want onto the philosophy.
Right. I mean, I actually really agree with you. I think that part of it does actually go back to sort of, you know, bits of 60s thought. I think, you know, I think there's sort of a, you know, there's something almost postmodern about like that sort of nature argument. That, you know, one of the weird things about postmodernism, and I say this as somebody who like studied lit at a, you know, studied literature at a university that was like very liberal and very dominated by postmodern scholars, is that it was sort of preoccupied first with making the argument that, you know, you should be sort of inside the text that you were studying and not really dealing with anything outside it, not dealing with context, not whatever it is. And at the same time, by doing that, like once you sort of stripped out anything that could be sort of tangential to the text, you were actually kind of left with nothing. That there was very little content to be talked about. And so you somehow, starting from that standpoint, you wound up at this place where, you know, there isn't really any truth to be arrived at, and there's sort of, it becomes navel-gazing.
Yeah.
You know, that it, somehow by, like, trying to narrow, I don't know, trying to be both too narrow and too broad at the same time, I think a lot of that scholarship wound up just really saying nothing. And I think that that's true of arguments like the purpose of environmentalism is to save nature. It's lacking in specificity, it's lacking in content. But it's because the specific fixes, like you said, require you to engage with technology, to engage with, you know, sort of the nature of the economy, all of these things, you know, these pieces of the existing society that sort of the deep ecology movement is bent on just getting rid of. It's not meant to be practical.
It's definitely not meant to be practical. In terms of postmodernism, I think you're right in the sense that a lot of the postmodern backlash was against the idea of human superiority. It sort of rejected the idea that humans were anything special.
Right.
You could find tons of articles, you know, talking about the scourge of anthropocentrism and how we need to, you know, stop the social construct of humans first.
Right.
But to me, that's sort of backwards. I mean, you know, this just saying it like I'm about to will sort of fall on the ground. If people who actually believe in postmodernism probably won't accept it just on my terms. But from my point of view, the aim of environmentalism should be to help the environment insofar as humans can appreciate it. I mean, fine, I understand the importance of biodiversity and I understand the importance of saving endangered species. I have nothing wrong with that, but to do it at the expense of saving a human life, or to do it or to push for environmental legislation that has absolutely nothing to do with improving the human condition, or that could even be appreciated by a human mind, seems to me sort of a wasted effort.
No, I agree with you. I mean, one case where it's sort of interesting, where it is happening, and where you're seeing that sort of economic cultural tension play out, is what happened to the biofuels movement. You know, biofuels were like championed by the environmental left because they are actually really clean tech, only to find that economic liberals started to push back at them really hard when it turned out that, well, you were like rapidly depleting the world food supply by like shoving this staple grain that's consumed in most of the poorest parts of the world, corn, into our cars. And, you know, so there was this panic about food shortages, and all of a sudden it became not okay to be sort of pro-ethanol. That's sort of shifting again because now we're moving in the direction of ethanol made from other things, from, you know, sugar, you know, sort of complicated plant modifications. But, you know, that's that was a case where, you know, where I think where economic liberalism fought back to some degree.
Right. I mean, whenever you're thinking about environmentalism, you have to keep in mind that trees don't actually feel anything. You know, I have an oak tree in my yard, and if I chopped it down, the tree that produced the seed that grew that oak tree isn't going to cry. And it's just an oak tree. It's a hunk of wood. But the postmodern thinkers, if you can call them that, sort of argued, well, who are you to say that man has more moral significance than a tree? But you know, it's all right to say that, but there's no reason to think that anything otherwise. That if you believe in morality in the first place, then I think it's imperative that man has more morality than a tree. But that's just me. It's sort of impossible to defend that position unless someone already believes in it. You need that level of common ground to
right.
at least know.
Right. Yeah. These arguments are at such a broad level that they can't be argued about. I sort of agree.
I hope you agree that trees.
Well, yeah. I mean, it becomes this kind of, well, you know, if one of the kind of fundamental tenets of your philosophy is that you can't ever really know anything. Then you become a very difficult person to have like constructive policy debates with.
Right.
And if you really push people who think like that, they'll sort of tell you at the end of the day that they, you know, that yielding productive policy is kind of not the goal. And I think that's when it becomes really frustrating, because then my argument is, well, you know, that's fine, but then really you should not be in such a prominent position in a political movement, and liberalism is a political movement.
Right.
You know, I think it would have been fine if this had stayed just within the ivory tower, but it hasn't. It's become the language of environmental policy, and I think it's changing now. I think what you're seeing, at least in the last year, I think you've started to see some pushback from sort of the center left, you know, that's starting to make the economic arguments. Which I think is going to be both good for the environment and good for the, you know, liberalism more generally. But I think, you know, it maybe set the environmental movement back a decade to be making the cultural arguments.
I sort of have another aspect of the 60s that I forgot to mention. The 60s counterculture was really concerned about, or really aware, at least, about mass culture and mass society,
right,
and anything mass-produced. So, you know, music wasn't bad intrinsically. It was bad because it was mainstream. School was pictured, you know, public education was pictured as sort of this assembly line where kids are coming out the other end, like in the Pink Floyd song. It was basically an aesthetic distaste for, you know, a certain it wasn't a rational argument. It was just the argument was too many people accept it, and then we have to reject it because everything that's true has to be alternative.
Mm-hmm.
And that I see that a lot in the criticisms of conventional farming practices, criticisms of by left wingers of Walmart. You know, sometimes you'll read some at least moderately persuasive arguments that about unionization and how Walmart needs to be unionized, but more often than not, the biggest thing when they're being candid is that Walmart is too sterile. That it's just a big box store. You know, everything's mass produced. Everyone's wearing uniforms.
Right.
And that to me seems pretty irrelevant to you know, what Walmart is. But that's sort of the ideology behind this.
No, I agree with you. I think, you know, and we talked about this over email a little bit. I've got this kind of conviction that the fundamental, you know, sort of political divide between people, and I think I've probably said this on the board somewhere, is, you know, the divide between people who whose faith is sort of placed in institutions and communities, and people whose faith is ultimately placed in, you know, in the individual and things that build up from there. And that, I think, there are right-wing and left-wing versions of both of those.
Definitely. Definitely. The countercultural movement started or was congruent with the right-wing libertarian movement.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So that what, and I think that people are realizing that now. So, like, you know, Brink Lindsey, who's been on Blogging Hands a bunch, right, has that sort of famous essay about libertarianism, where he's making exactly that argument, right, that economic and social libertarians who have historically been on opposite sides of the political divide have more in common with each other than, you know, what I would consider to be their institutionalist counterparts, right? So that, you know, people who are sort of, you know, Ross Douthat style conservatives, people who are willing to have the government spend money if they spend it on social causes, people who, you know, that kind of thing, have more in common with economic liberals than they've sort of previously realized. That, I think, is kind of centrally the divide that we're talking about.
Right. And another thing you see coming out of the 60s, or at least is, you know, part of the domino effect of the 60s, and which I think is connected with, for example, the organic movement and the deep ecology movements are, I think they're definitely connected with alternative medicine movements and, you know, sort of naturopathy therapy favoring, rejecting sort of the Prozac nation in favor of taking herbs and other sort of
Even if it's not kind of tested or anything.
Right, homeopathic remedies and stuff like this, which, again, isn't because those things have any genuine credibility to them, but it's because they're against mainstream. They're against mainstream medicine. So what does that have to do with the organic movement? They talk a lot about toxicity and sort of these environmental pollutants that are inside of us. So it seems sort of natural that the environmental movement sort of, if you look hard enough, has these sort of alternative medicine whack jobs in them. And they're definitely connected with the left wing. Don't get me wrong, there's definitely right wing in alternative medicine whack jobs. But it seems a little more accepted in liberal circles. I mean, the Huffington Post has this absurd homeopath that gets featured articles all the time, I guess because Arianna Huffington sort of has this thing for homeopathic medicine. And, you know, more recently in the news is Bill Maher complaining about vaccinations. And that definitely has something to do with the countercultural critique of mass society.
Right. Oh, it's like it's so bad to vaccinate people against actually threatening diseases because it would be so we'd live in a sterilized society or something like that.
Yeah, and plus big pharma will make profit. And
right.
They sort of there's conspiratorial arguments. You know, in the 60s they said that you know you can't put fluoride in the water. that will, you're poisoning us. It's just a government conspiracy, you know, in the pocket of a big corporation, some fluoride corporation. And now Bill Maher, 40 years later, is complaining about vaccinations because of his distaste for pharmacological companies.
No, I totally agree with you. We've been talking for half an hour, so we are going to have to end this at some point. But I think the problem with it and the reason it's so dangerous is that a lot of times they're sometimes right about the policies. And so what happens is economic liberals arrive at the same conclusions, and the flaws in the way that cultural liberals get to those arguments are, you know, left unchallenged. There are some things where I think they're just wrong, some things where I think they're not. I think the argumentation is really weak.
Well, okay, if we have to wrap it up pretty soon, I think we should finish on our solutions. Which I think are way more interesting than actually the history. So coming off from our logic, if we reject deep ecology, we should be in favor of something called a shallow ecology, I guess, which is an actual term that that deep ecologists sort of, it's a pejorative term if you're in deep ecology. But basically that just means institutional fixes, sort of carbon taxes, cap and trade, this sort of thing, which is quote-unquote merely institutional. But from just as a quick outline of what I think should be done, first I think it should be recognized that environmental problems like global warming are human problems, they're human catastrophes. And we have to recognize that the people who are going to feel it most are people who live in subsistent countries that are that whose economies are non-diverse, who, you know, are really liable to experience a drought, things like this. I don't think despite the videos of Manhattan going underwater, I sincerely don't think that the human toll of global warming is going to be in North America. I think it's going to be in Africa. So from that,
or the Indian Ocean, there are a bunch of, you know, I mean, there are a whole, like, you know, island nations there that are going to be wiped out.
Definitely. From that premise, it would lead you to think that one way of combating global warming would be to, you know, try to reduce carbon emissions and everything else. But another way to do it would be to prepare the countries that are most unprotected. In other words, to develop them economically. Seems sort of so far against what most environmentalists are pushing for. They're normally anti-trade, they're normally anti-globalization. But it seems to me that, you know, it's not one or the other. We can do both. But if you can bring to an African country or bring to an impoverished country a good level of infrastructure, a good level of health practices, sanitation, a good level of capital, then in effect you're preempting the effects that global warming will have upon them. So my two solutions would be sort of develop the people who are most at risk and look for sort of institutional, really ingenious and smart fixes. I think most of the problems of environmentalism are shallow and superficial in their nature. For example, the reason I live in Nova Scotia, so the Atlantic Ocean, I can walk to it from my house. And it used to be, I guess, brimming of cod. I wasn't alive back then, but I guess it used to just be full of cod, and now they're basically all gone because people came and took them all, ate them all, and they couldn't replenish their populations.
Right.
But that problem wasn't some deep problem with human nature. It was basically because it was basically a tragedy of the commons. There was no one owning property. You can't own the ocean.
So there was no regulation to stop them from doing so. Right.
Right. So, you know, that's sort of a tricky one for the whole Atlantic Ocean, but it sort of gives you an idea of how something simple like a property right is just a small institutional legal reform, which would have prevented it from happening in the first place.
Right, right. No. I see your point. I agree with you. The only place I think we disagree is I think that more of that is happening now. So you know, we talked about, you know, like the fundamental institutional reforms that could be made now, things like a cap and trade system. I mean, we're talking about those now.
Yeah.
I think that something has happened in the last 2 or 3 years to sort of change the conversation. I think Katrina played a big part in that because it was this major environmental catastrophe, but its effect was disproportionately felt by the poor. And I think it sort of reawakened the economic liberal arguments for, you know, environmental policy. And I think that's when the pushback started.
Right. I mean, most of this stuff is taking place, most of this new left critique is in North America, maybe some parts of Western Europe, because basically that's where the 60s occurred. But where places were sort of sheltered from the countercultural critique, places like Sweden and Denmark. Sweden and Denmark are doing wonderfully to fight climate change. Sweden, just with a carbon tax and some what I think are ingenious, but in retrospect kind of obvious sort of measures to fight, you know, traffic congestion and stuff like this.
Right.
Their carbon emissions are well below what the Kyoto Protocol originally asked for. And same with Denmark. So they're doing it. But the New Left critique is not going to get anywhere if it doesn't want to replicate that, because we have to remember that Sweden's economy is like over 90% private. It's it's an export-oriented country, so it's really involved with global trade. This all seems sort of extremely high-growth capitalist, sort of neoliberal almost, but at the same time, it gets criticized in America as being a socialist country.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the solutions that they're offering and putting up on the table are proving themselves in the test of time. But so long as the new left sort of even denies the chance of capitalism of actually working, even if it's highly regulated, then we're not going to get anywhere.
Right. No, I agree with you. I think that's a good place to sign off.